You know, nothing says the holidays quite like the cold storage of the NPR tape library. This is Carrie Thompson, and I have here in my mittened hands some really fun, frosty, festive stories from the days of yore. This month, our Happy Holiday edition of Playback features composer Johnny Marks, who gives us the backstory on his song about the most famous reindeer of all. Rudolph the
Red-Nosed. This I wrote down and for 10 years did nothing with it. And then I did write it, and I would rate it as easily one of the worst songs ever written.
Stay tuned to find out if one of the worst songs ever written really is one of the worst songs ever written. And we have a holiday travelogue from Ira Glass, roaming the city streets of Chicago on Christmas night. Why would he take that assignment? Would it have something to do with discovering the true meaning of Christmas?
So what's the Christmas spirit mean to you tonight?
Double time after 4:30 in the morning. That's the Christmas spirit.
But before we get to any of that, the ghost of Christmas past would like to take us to the warm and cozy family home of Susan Stamberg.
Hello.
Hi, Josh. Merry Christmas.
Hi.
Have you had a good day?
Yep.
What's been going on?
Oh, not much. Open my presents.
Uh-huh.
I got some clothes, food. Very mature Christmas, I might say.
No little toys. I've been talking to kids all day.
No fire engine.
But what's going to be the best thing today?
Oh, driving.
Driving?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Going out driving with Dad. Being in the driver's seat myself, that is. Oh, I'll be getting my license in a few days. And just practicing for it.
Honey, you know, the last time I talked to you on the radio, you were 3 years old. So you're going to be driving.
Yep.
Give your mother something else to worry about.
Off the roads.
Well, good luck. Have a good driving lesson. Merry Christmas. I'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Sitting in a lonely radio studio on Christmas night. That's quite a concept. Ira Glass wondered about all the people not opening presents on Christmas. Who were they and what were they doing? He set off through the streets of Chicago to find out.
Christmas morning, 2 a.m. Time for one thing. Bowling.
Come on, Charo. Yes. Oh.
At Waveland Bowl, for hours after midnight, 25 out of 40 lanes were in use. There were kids everywhere. The rest of the crowd was mostly people in their teens and 20s. There were guys who bowl four nights a week and saw no reason to take off Christmas Eve. There were some Muslim guys from Pakistan and some Vietnamese guys who don't celebrate the holiday either. And there were lots of families.
That's my aunt and her husband. This is my sister and her husband. This is my little brother, and that's my husband.
This crowd had a big traditional dinner earlier in the evening with the older relatives, with turkey, roast pork, and then they wanted some fun.
Did you guys go to church?
The older people, they go to church, and the younger people...
They pray for us. They go to pray for us, and we can't play for them. Because they are too old, and they say, oh, we can't do it. So the youngest people, we can't over here.
Down in lanes 13 and 14, it's a very different scene. A bunch of guys in their early 30s, friends from boyhood, are carrying on a tradition they say goes back 13 years. They're Jewish, and every Christmas Eve, they come out bowling together at midnight.
The idea is that you cannot bowl throughout the year. One bowls. If they win, they get a trophy, and they meet another year.
Who gives the trophy?
It's passed down. The winner gets it 1 year, and then the winner the next year is passed down.
They joke around and videotape the game. For people who supposedly only bowl once a year, their scores are astonishingly high. 209, 210.
I just bowl on Christmas Eve, and I just get up for it. There's a certain little Christmas energy that I think Jewish guys have. And I just really work on that. You know, I feed off that, and it translates into the best bowling I've ever done in my life, 210.
There were intimations that they had slipped a few extra frames into the first game to boost the scores. Jews in Chicago had many entertainment options last night. There were three dances for Jewish singles in trendy downtown clubs. One dance was called the Matzah Ball. And in the Jewish suburb of Skokie, the Lowe's Old Orchard Movie Theater was having one of its busiest nights of the year. None of the other Lowe's theaters in the metropolitan area had enough business to run late shows. This one was pulling in $20,000 to $25,000. It was hard to find parking. Today, the theater expects even more business. The new Barbara Streisand movie opened there this afternoon. But as for last night, it's a truism, a joke among many Jews, that Christmas Eve is the time for a movie and Chinese food.
You tell me what else is open on Christmas Eve. Generally, it's Chinese food. The Sichuan peanut chicken was delicious. The mushu pork, you don't want to know all this, do you?
You guys ate pork on Christmas Eve?
It's traditional pork on Christmas, of course.
Jim, that thing moving along.
Lots of people are working today. Police, nurses, convenience store clerks, utility maintenance crews. Late last night and early this morning, this crew at the corner of Southport near Irving Park tried to pull a bad electrical cable out of the ground. This wasn't an emergency. The repair will be finished tomorrow. They were just working the regular shift, doing their normal work. Though, because it was Christmas, they weren't assigned to do anything too strenuous. And the foreman let them take the time to go pick up some ribs for dinner. Chris Gibbs says he's worked the last five Christmases.
Nobody really complains. We go out, we had a nice dinner, you know, and we're not killing ourselves tonight.
So what's the Christmas spirit mean to you tonight?
Double time after 4:30 in the morning. That's the Christmas spirit. But it's not bad. It's a job. We're working. A lot of people at GM aren't, you know.
At the Golden Apple 24-hour restaurant on Lincoln Avenue, in the earliest hours of this morning, some of the regulars were hanging out. Two of the waitresses, Mary and Bridget, stuck around past the end of their shifts. Every now and then, they'd sing what they remembered of a Christmas carol, and they joked with the regulars, who were mostly men, old and not so old. To a newcomer, some of their inside jokes seemed a little strange, like the one where they and a friendly guy named Ed tease each other about how they are, all of them, losers.
He's a loser, Ed.
He's considered a loser.
Yeah, he lost his job. He's been out of work for months, and he's living off his life savings.
And his name is Ed.
And his name is Ed.
And we call him Loser.
Not everyone got this treatment, of course. At one table, an older man named Charlie D. O'Brien was keeping to himself in a tie, vest, coat, and hunting cap, writing industriously in a tiny notebook.
Oh, book. I write my own books occasionally, and I'm just trying to compile, but I never get publication, what the heck. You know, I like to dabble into both sometimes religion and social sciences and philosophy once in a while and physical science of the universe, too.
For a while, he told me about his family and his ideas about how the Irish have been dispersed around the world and made powerless. He looked out the restaurant's plate glass windows at the Catholic church across the street. He said he spent so long trying to decide if he should attend midnight mass that he missed it. I asked him if he had a Christmas wish.
My Christmas wish for the coming year is to reestablish out of my homelessness. That is, I have been a bear for organization, but right now I'm just camping out.
Donna, the senior waitress at the Golden Apple, said the tips are better on Christmas. People are more appreciative, and there are more single men in the restaurant.
I think the loners are out tonight.
That's the thing I was wondering about, if somebody in your job ends up having to, I don't know, just sort of look after people who are alone on a night like this.
Well, I'm the one that does that. So, you know, I work the night shift, so I take care of the cab drivers and the cops. And bake them some cookies for the cab drivers, because they usually are kind of loners, too, so I baked them some cookies for Christmas.
It was a tray of cookies so big, the other waitresses teased her about it. Crescents and pfeffernisse and sugar cookies. She gave them out all night long last night. There were so many that there will be some left when she comes on the late shift tonight. I'm Ira Glass in Chicago.
You know Dasher and Dancer and
yeah,
Dancer,
you know them. And I'm willing to bet you'd like to forget them. Composer Johnny Marks made sure we never did when he created his most famous song. He talked to reporter Bill Tuohy.
Rudolph was written by veteran songwriter Johnny Marks. In addition to Rudolph, he's given us three other Christmas hits: I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day, Holly Jolly Christmas, and that great standard, Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree. But Rudolph, written in 1949, is his biggest hit. We talked about the song and its success in the living room of his Greenwich Village apartment. Marks told me Rudolph was more a creature of accident than design.
I had seen a little book about Rudolph, and I keep, it's on the piano, a book. It's got notepaper where I write tunes, and it has 30 pages where I write ideas, titles. This I wrote down, and for 10 years did nothing with it. And then in 1948, I did write it, and I would rate it as easily one of the worst songs ever written. And if you want to hear what it sounded like,
I would
tell you. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Well, I realized this is just dying away. There's no tune. And I just threw whatever I had away. The following year, I was walking along the street, and the tune came to me, which is a reverse. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And then for the tune, I had da 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 dee dee. Well, when I got home, I finished the tune, took the old lyric that I had, and rewrote it to fit the new tune, and that's the song the way you know it. Now, that's accident number one. Accident number two. Among many people I sent it to was a fellow by the name of Gene Autry, who was a cowboy singing star. And he got it, and he told me later, I did not know him at the time, we have become close friends since. He played it over, and he liked it. So he took it home with eight other songs to pick four for his next record session. And when he came to Rudolph, he said, Johnny, I decided that's not for me. But Ina, that's his wife, said, Gene, I think that song, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, is the most wonderful songs I ever heard. Do me a favor. Put it on one side of the record and put what you think is a hit on the other side. And so he did. So you can see it's all just a lucky accident.
You know, there's a whole lot of heavy social significance in that song about the outcast who looks funny, who becomes the big hero of the night. Presumably that occurred to you somewhere along the line.
Well, now, I've got to be honest. I've heard all of this many, many times. When I tell you, I didn't think anything about it. I was a moderately successful songwriter, and I was just trying to write a good song that told a story, and I never thought about all these other aspects which have since been analyzed over and over. Why was it a hit? And I don't go along with them. I say the song was a hit because it was, for me, the perfect wedding of words and music. I write a lot of songs and they don't turn out right. Mm-hmm. This one did turn out right.
Do you like the song? I mean, are you really pleased with it?
Well, what am I going to say after 29 or 30 years? I certainly liked it when I wrote it. I must admit I could get a little tired of hearing it. Well, or even talking about it.
That's what I was wondering, if after 29 years would you wish that people said, well, he also wrote, and get into some other parts of it.
Now you're in my big frustration, because I have written four very big hit Christmas songs, and no matter how big they are, people will say, but it's not another Rudolph.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear one of those other ones that you like.
Well, I like one that Bing Crosby just did on his Christmas show called I Heard the Bell on Christmas Day, their old familiar carols play, and wild and sweet the words repeat of peace on earth, goodwill to men. I was reading a book of Longfellow, and in the book I came across a poem called Christmas Bells. It opened, I heard the bells on Christmas Day as you heard me sing it. And that was during the Korean War, and I just said, this is what the world needs today, a message of peace on earth, goodwill to men. But while we're talking, it reminds me of one of my all-time biggest flops. It was a single record. It was Gene Autry, and I thought, and he did one of the best songs I ever wrote, and it was called Everyone's a Child at Christmas, which I thought it was a philosophical thought. I don't even remember the song. The record came out. It did nothing. The song did nothing. And that's the way it goes.
So you couldn't play a couple of bars for us?
Well, I remember the opening. Let me think. Everyone's a child at Christmas and loves the happy holiday jollity, so forth. And it ends up, everyone's a child at Christmas because Christmas is for children like you and me. I mean, I just felt it had all the elements of the hit. Because, you know, we are all children at Christmas. All this Christmas trees and wreaths and all the things that go with it. Do you agree with me? We're really children at Christmas. Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer had a very shiny nose, and if you ever saw it, you would even say it glows.
Christmas has been good to Johnny Marks. Along with the hit songs, he's written the music for three television specials, and now he's hard at work on a full-length film on Rudolph. He's protected the rights to all this through his own company, called appropriately St. Nicholas Music. This is Bill Toohey in New York.
Have a holly jolly Christmas. It's the best time.
Not only did Johnny Marks write Rudolph, he also wrote Holly Jolly Christmas, We Are Santa's Elves, Jingle, 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 Rocking Around the Christmas Tree, The Island of Misfit Toys, Silver and Gold, and you get the idea.
Ho, ho, the mistletoe hung where you can see. Somebody waits.
I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.
Have a holly jolly Christmas. And in case you didn't hear.
And so, to complete the holiday scenario, here's Susan Stamberg.
I like hearing stories on Christmas Day, even if I have to read them myself, and even if it means reading with a bit of a stuffy nose, if you can bear it. Please let me share my favorite holiday story with you, The Gift of the Magi by O. Henry. It's one of the very first stories that I can remember reading in the very same book that I'm reading from today, a 1948 genuine pocketbook of O. Henry, a collection of 30 of his finest short stories. This book was a gift from my father, who greatly admired O. Henry. That was his pen name, by the way. He was born William Sidney Porter in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1862. My paperback book is quite brittle now, but I treasure it as much today as I did when I received it at the age of 10. The Gift of the Magi, written in 1905, is still a magical story for me about romance and love and caring and holiday feeling. $1.87, that was all. And 60 cents of it was in pennies. Pennies saved one and two at a time by bulldozing the grocer and the vegetable man and the butcher until one's cheeks burned with the silent imputation of parsimony that such close dealing implied. Three times, Della counted it, $1.87. And the next day would be Christmas. There was clearly nothing to do but flop down on the shabby little couch and howl. So Della did it. Which instigates the moral reflection that life is made up of sobs, sniffles, and smiles, with sniffles predominating. While the mistress of the home is gradually subsiding from the first stage to the second, take a look at the home. A furnished flat at $8 per week. It did not exactly beggar description, but it certainly had that word on the lookout for the mendicancy squad. In the vestibule below was a letter box into which no letter would go, and an electric button from which no mortal finger could coax a ring. Also appertaining thereunto was a card bearing the name Mr. James Dillingham Young. The Dillingham had been flung to the breeze during a former period of prosperity when its possessor was being paid $30 a week. Now, when the income was shrunk to 20, the letters of Dillingham looked blurred, as though they were thinking seriously of contracting to a modest and unassuming D. But whenever Mr. James Dillingham Young came home and reached his flat above, he was called Jim and greatly hugged by Mrs. James Dillingham Young, already introduced to you as Della, which is all very good. Della finished her cry and attended to her cheeks with the powder rag. She stood by the window and looked out dully at a gray cat walking a gray fence in a gray backyard. Tomorrow would be Christmas Day, and she had only $1.87 with which to buy Jim a present. She had been saving every penny she could for months with this result. $20 a week doesn't go far. Expenses had been greater than she had calculated. They always are. Only $1.87 to buy a present for Jim, her Jim. Many a happy hour she had spent planning for something nice for him, something fine and rare and sterling, something just a little bit near to being worthy of the honor of being owned by Jim. There was a pier glass between the windows of the room. Perhaps you have seen a pier glass in an $8 flat. A very thin and very agile person may, by observing his reflection in a rapid sequence of longitudinal strips, obtain a fairly accurate conception of his looks. Della, being slender, had mastered the art. Suddenly she whirled from the window and stood before the glass. Her eyes were shining brilliantly, but her face had lost its color within 20 seconds. Rapidly, she pulled down her hair and let it fall to its full length. Now, there were two possessions of the James Dillingham Youngs in which they both took a mighty pride. One was Jim's gold watch that had been his father's and his grandfather's. The other was Della's hair. Had the Queen of Sheba lived in the flat across the air shaft, Della would have let her hair hang out the window some day to dry just to depreciate Her Majesty's jewels and gifts. Had King Solomon been the janitor with all his treasures piled up in the basement, Jim would have pulled out his watch every time he passed just to see him pluck at his beard from envy. So now Della's beautiful hair fell about her, rippling and shining like a cascade of brown waters. And then she did it up again nervously and quickly. Once she faltered for a minute and stood still while a tear or two splashed on the worn red carpet. On went her old brown jacket, on went her old brown hat. Skirts, and with the brilliant sparkle still in her eyes, she fluttered out the door and down the stairs to the street. Where she stopped, the sign read, Madame Sofroni, Hair Goods of All Kinds. One flight up, Della ran and collected herself, panting. Madam, large, too white, chilly, hardly looked the Sofroni. Will you buy my hair? Asked Della. I buy hair, said Madam. Take off your hat and let's have a sight at the looks of it. Down rippled the brown cascade. $20, said Madam, lifting the mass with a practiced hand. Give it to me quick, said Della. Oh, and the next 2 hours tripped by on rosy wings. Forget the hashed metaphor. She was ransacking the stores for Jim's present. She found it at last. It surely had been made for Jim and no one else. There was no other like it in any of the stores, and she had turned all of them inside out. It was a platinum fob chain, simple and chaste in design, properly proclaiming its value by substance alone and not by meretricious ornamentation, as all good things should do. It was even worthy of the watch. As soon as she saw it, she knew that it must be Jim's. It was like him. Quietness and value. The description applied to both. $21 they took from her for it, and she hurried home with the 87 cents. With that chain on his watch, Jim might be properly anxious about the time in any company. Grand as the watch was, he sometimes looked at it on the sly on account of the old leather strap that he used in place of a chain. When Della reached home, her intoxication gave way a little to prudence and reason. She got out her curling irons and lighted the gas and went to work repairing the ravages made by generosity added to love. Which is always a tremendous task, dear friends, a mammoth task. Within 40 minutes, her head was covered with tiny, close-lying curls that made her look wonderfully like a truant schoolboy. She looked at her reflection in the mirror long, carefully, and critically. If Jim doesn't kill me, she said to herself, before he takes a second look at me, he'll say I look like a Coney Island chorus girl. But what could I do? Oh, what could I do with $1.87? At 7 o'clock, the coffee was made and the frying pan was on the back of the stove, hot and ready to cook the chops. Jim was never late. Della doubled the fob chain in her hand and sat on the corner of the table near the door that he always entered. Then she heard his step on the stair, away down on the first flight, and she turned white for just a moment. She had a habit of saying little silent prayers about the simplest everyday things, and now she whispered, "Please, God, make him think I am still pretty." The door opened, and Jim stepped in and closed it. He looked thin and very serious. Poor fellow, he was only 22, and to be burdened with a family. He needed a new overcoat, and he was without gloves. Jim stopped inside the door, as immovable as a setter at the scent of quail. His eyes were fixed upon Della, and there was an expression in them that she could not read, and it terrified her. It was not anger, nor surprise, nor disapproval, nor horror, nor any of the sentiments that she had been prepared for. He simply stared at her fixedly with that peculiar expression on his face. Della wriggled off the table and went for him. "Jim, darling," she cried, "don't look at me that way. I had my hair cut off and sold it because I couldn't have lived through Christmas without giving you a present. It'll grow out again. You won't mind, will you? I just had to do it. My hair grows awfully fast. Say Merry Christmas, Jim, and let's be happy. You don't know what a beautiful, nice gift I've got for you." "You've cut off your hair?" asked Jim laboriously, as if he had not arrived at that patent fact yet, even after the hardest mental labor. "Cut it off and sold it," said Della. "Don't you like me just as well, anyhow? I'm me without my hair, ain't I?" Jim looked about the room curiously. "You say your hair is gone," he said, with an air almost of idiocy. "You needn't look for it," said Della. "It's sold, I tell you, sold and gone, too. It's Christmas Eve, boy. Be good to me, for it went for you. Maybe the hairs of my head were numbered," she went on with a sudden serious sweetness, "but nobody could ever count my love for you. Shall I put the chops on, Jim?" Out of his trance, Jim seemed quickly to wake. He enfolded his Della. For 10 seconds, let us regard with discreet scrutiny some inconsequential object in the other direction. $8 a week or $1 million a year, what is the difference? A mathematician or a wit would give you the wrong answer. The Magi brought valuable gifts, but that was not among them. This dark assertion will be illuminated later on. Jim drew a package from his overcoat pocket and threw it upon the table. "Don't make any mistake, Del," he said, "about me. I don't think there's anything in the way of a haircut or a shave or a shampoo that could make me like my girl any less. But if you'll unwrap that package, you may see why you had me going a while at first." White fingers and nimble tore at the string and paper, and then an ecstatic scream of joy, and then, alas, a quick change to hysterical tears and wails, necessitating the immediate employment of all the comforting powers of the lord of the flat. For there lay the combs, the set of combs, side and back, that Della had worshipped for long in a Broadway window. Beautiful combs, pure tortoiseshell, with jeweled rims, just the shade to wear in the beautiful vanished hair. They were expensive combs, she knew, and her heart had simply craved and yearned over them without the least hope of possession. And now they were hers, but the tresses that should have adorned the coveted adornments were gone. But she hugged them to her bosom, and at length she was able to look up with dim eyes and a smile and say, "My hair grows so fast, Jim." And then Della leaped up like a little singed cat and cried, "Oh, oh!" Jim had not yet seen his beautiful present. She held it out to him eagerly upon her open palm. The dull, precious metal seemed to flash with a reflection of her bright and ardent spirit. "Isn't it a dandy, Jim? I hunted all over town to find it. You'll have to look at the time 100 times a day now. Give me your watch. I want to see how it looks on it." Instead of obeying, Jim tumbled down on the couch and put his hand under the back of his head and smiled. "Del," said he, "let's put our Christmas presents away and keep them a while. They're too nice to use just at present. I sold the watch to get the money to buy your combs. And now suppose you put the chops on." The Magi, as you know, were wise men, wonderfully wise men, who brought gifts to the babe in the manger. They invented the art of giving Christmas presents. Being wise, their gifts were no doubt wise ones, possibly bearing the privilege of exchange in case of duplication. And here I have lamely related to you the uneventful chronicle of 2 foolish children in a flat who most unwisely sacrificed for each other the greatest treasures of their house. But in a last word to the wise of these days, let it be said that of all who give gifts, these 2 were the wisest. Of all who give and receive gifts, such as they are wisest. Everywhere they are wisest. They are the Magi.
That was Susan Stamberg reading The Gift of the Magi by O. Henry. Special thanks for this month's playback go to our Time Magazine Radio Guy of the Year, Mr. Michael Katziff. Happy holidays, everybody. Next year, we'll be digging through the NPR archives circa 1986 to find the best, the kindest, the gentlest, the most radiophonic stories ever to be dug out of cold storage. And lucky for me, those are very easy to find. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.